Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Yale head coach Andy Shea as we continue the countdown to September 1st by talking about recruiting, how coaches go about the practice in an effort to try to help folks understand a little better how coaches go about the practice. Andy Shea, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm honored.
Well, honored is a stretch. We're going to change up the format a little bit relative to the first three in this series that we did. And if you haven't listened, check out Navy's Joe Amplo, Ohio State's Nick Myers, and Virginia's Lars Tiffany, where we really structured those conversations around essentially evaluation and communication. But Andy, I am familiar enough with a combination of your program and your approach where I'd rather kind of structure this conversation like a timeline. And I'll get to the reasons why kind of as we advance over the course of the last 17, 18 years. But that's where I want to start, is kind of the beginning. You take over a program, you're a first-time head coach, and while Yale had had some great teams historically, the program that you kind of inherited had some work to be done from a rebuilding standpoint. At that time, how did you recruit? How did you kind of decide who you wanted to go after, and how did you try to sell them on the dream of being a Bulldog?
Yeah, I think we really didn't know kind of what we were doing at first. We just recruited who we thought we were supposed to recruit, I think, and went to the aisles that you historically shop in of these types of kids. And didn't really have, when I got hired, maybe I wasn't ready for it, or I didn't really have an idea of, how we were going to, do this thing. So we went with what we thought, we were supposed to recruit, and we didn't think too far outside the box. And I think we got some really good kids in those classes. But, I think that we really doubled down and made some non-negotiables that really helped us out moving into the future.
So when you talk about those aisles that you were traditionally supposed to shop in, where did the Chaminade Flyers specifically fall into that category? And how important was a player like Brennan Gibson in terms of building the foundation of the program that got Yale into Ivy League tournament and eventually NCAA tournament contention?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Chaminade was always important to, to our program. And I was lucky enough, my first assistant here at Graham Neamey had a really good relationship with those guys. And I think that I've tried to foster that, over the years. Getting my second year, my captain here was a Chaminade guy. But we, Chaminade was a school that we didn't have to, we didn't have to wait for the top guys. I should say some of the schools, some high schools, the coaches were like, you can have, I know you're looking at this kid, but this is the kid you're going to get. And he was second and third and down the list of their best players. So I think Chaminade, for whatever reason, we ended up attracting Brendan. And I think that gave us a little bit of credibility with some of these other guys, and certainly helped get his brother Matt, who was, an excellent player. But Brendan was more than just a good player. He was a great leader. He's one of the best captains I've ever had. So, it was definitely a big jump when he came on board and obviously contributed on the field, but off the field too.
I've written extensively about the role that the Ivy League tournament, the creation of the Ivy League tournament, played in the development of your program from the standpoint of, ensuring that your season wasn't determined by mid-March and allowing you to continue to practice and develop and get better over the course of the subsequent 6 weeks and put in a position where everything was still in front of you leading up to late April. And so from, say, 2010 to 2013, your program continued to develop. During that period of time, obviously, Yale's admission standards are among the most competitive in the country. How did the function of admissions play a role, you know, both from when you took over the job to when you started to find success in the postseason, and then as the success in the postseason became more of an expectation as opposed to an outlier event?
Yeah, I think, you know, the interesting thing that I don't know if a lot of people know is that we were the Yale University Athletics had restricted their numbers dramatically in the athletic department. They didn't, there was a book that had come out called The Game of Life, I think it was the name of it. It's written by our president's daughter. And at the time it became the fashion to kind of, you know, reduce the number of athletic spots. And we went down to something really dramatic, like 180 or 85 or something like that. That was difficult for my athletic director to deal with, because football was getting whatever they needed. So a large roster sport, of males that could give up a lot of spots that, you know, maybe they didn't think could be any good, was lacrosse. So we had, you know, we had gone down to 7 a year, and that was my first, I guess, 6 or 7 years. But then it came to, you know, kind of a moment where I had, you know, told the boss that it wasn't going to be, we weren't ever going to find success. And he kind of agreed, and he gave me about 9 or 10 that year, and we ended up kind of winning the league, I think, from that first class. And I think he saw, okay, maybe we got something here. Maybe we could, you know, we could make some progress here. And I, you know, when we were getting 7 a year, I recruited my second goalie, I think, in my 6th year, something crazy like that. I mean, we were recruiting one defenseman and a bunch, you know, a number of middies to try and maybe convert guys in the future. We were really hamstrung, but you know, it was tough on those kids still. Those kids that wanted to be part of something and maybe, you know, just didn't understand that the numbers were going to be stacked against them, especially if somebody had an ACL or something like that. So the 2010 class that won the league was 7 kids. We had 2 kids retire for injuries and whatever reasons. And so I think they graduated with 5. So, you know, it's really an incredible accomplishment that we were able to make that jump that year. The admissions requirements in general, though, I'm on my 3rd admissions dean, and they've all kind of held the same standards. If anything, it's gotten harder to get in here by the numbers. But I think more than anything else is my dean of admissions wants good kids and wants, you know, he doesn't want to hear from me, hey, this kid's got a 4.0 GPA and 1550 SATs. Like, we need to take this kid. He wants kids that are going to make an, you know, that they're going to engage in Yale and you know, make the most of their opportunity here. And you know, and I think that you know, me trusting in that, and I think, you know, him trusting me has led to a really good relationship that's allowed me to get guys that maybe we wouldn't normally get. And the strictures that he puts me under, honestly, have made the best rosters that I could possibly imagine. Like, it's the you know, I can't just throw numbers out there. I have to say, okay, this kid is, you know, this is who he is. And then we have to be a little more diligent with how we explore kids, you know, past. If a kid's maybe a discipline issue or, you know, not necessarily loved in his high school community, despite the fact that he's brilliant, the dean might call me and say, hey, listen, I have some reservations about this kid. And never is it, you know, yes or no. It's just, hey, we need to talk about this kid. And, you know, there have been times that in the evaluation process, I've, you know, kind of held my ground and wanted to take a chance on a kid. And there's been times when, you know, he's wanted to hold his ground a little bit more. The older I get, the more I'm in this, the more I realize that the process that we have here, you know, you really want to trust it along the way, because it's gotten me some of the best kids that, left to my own devices, I would have, you know, gotten some other guys, maybe a little bit better players, but not necessarily the commitment that we need.
We're going to come back to that, but I want to advance the conversation to 2013, because I do think that a lot of this ties together. Your season ended with a 7-6 loss to Syracuse in the quarterfinals at College Park. What was your main takeaway from that game in terms of what you needed to do from a roster building standpoint going forward?
I know you're going to say that it was I think that we had a bunch of kids that believed they could do it. That was a kid that was the on the heels of the 2012 team that went to the NCAAs, and in the moment when we beat Princeton in the finals and played Notre Dame, we were kind of happy to be there. And you know, then you go into the 2013 year and you're like, well, we're not just happy to be here. We're going to, you know, if we can make it again, we're going to make the most of it. And then as a coach, you're like, geez, I hope we can make it again. You know, it had been 20 years since we'd gone to the NCAA tournament. So, you know, I don't think that I was delusional to think that we were going to make it again, especially since we had lost so many guys that were really good. But those guys kind of willed their way to, you know, going to the quarterfinals and potentially going to the Final Four. And, you know, we look at it like, you know, if we were able to get in the Final Four, who knows what would have happened with that team. So, I don't know. I think maybe more than anything else, it was the power of belief and, you know, just what great kids can do and how the, you know, what they can do, that their achievements were so great relative to the sum of the parts. It's just a really special team. So you kind of hope to rekindle that just with great kids that are going to listen to everything you say and trust you and go from there.
Well, so
is that the question you were fishing for?
No, not even close.
Okay.
You've told me a few times that you felt like, you were able to win at each end of the field, but in the middle of the field, an injection of athleticism was one of the things that you were going to focus on in that subsequent summer. And I don't know the timeline of who committed when to know whether you had already had Jason Alessi and Tyler Warner, but I'm pretty confident that you identified John Danagelis, Jack Tye, Joey Sessa, and a handful of others that ended up being the core of the 2018 National Championship team that summer on the heels of that kind of takeaway. Do I have that right?
I sometimes have to think back. I know Joey Sessa was at the Ivy tournament because it was close to his house and he talks about it. The freshman, those guys that won it in 2018 would have been high school seniors that next year.
Correct.
They graduated in 2014. So,
do you think you had Warner and Alessi committed at that point, or did they commit that summer going into their senior year?
Warner, yes. Alessi was coming for football.
Right.
So he wasn't necessarily committed to us. But, you know, Connor Mackey, yes. Ben Reeves was later that summer, I think. I think most of them were right around that time, but it wasn't like a.
But then the juniors, the high school class of 2015, you largely got that summer, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and that's Danagelis and Ty and Brennan Mackey came from.
Correct. Yes.
So were you?
I think so.
Were you committed to that athletic projection component to it?
Nope. No, we had not. We had not looked at that the athletic projection as a model until we started getting better athletically with the guys that we had.
You're right.
I think we got lucky.
Yeah, I misspoke. I didn't mean it in the sense of kind of where you have developed now. I meant more so just in terms of like the emphasis from an eye test standpoint on those types of players.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that those guys were just better. The class of 2019 was just a better. We felt like it was a better class in aggregate talent in terms of perception from the outside, and it was better on the inside. I thought that was, I was like, wow, this is, we really nailed it with a lot of these guys. You know, John Danajelis' sister went to Yale. He was, you know, one of the more coveted guys on the island. So we ended up getting him. Joey Sessa was under recruited, but, you know, we saw a lot in him. Jack Tye was once again, highly coveted, but I think he just had, I think he wanted to come to Yale, and we did a good job recruiting him. You know, Brendan Mackey was going to Amherst, and he called us up and said he wanted to play with his brother. And so, you know, we had to do that. But I'm trying to think who else. You know, every kid was a little bit different in their story. But they were all, we thought it was going to be a really good class, and we thought, people thought it was really good as well.
So you teed this up already. I know that this is proprietary in some respect, and there are aspects of it that you're not going to want to talk about, but to the extent that you are comfortable talking about it, how do you describe this evolution toward emphasizing what a 16, 17-year-old projects as an athlete, if you can get them into your system and see what they become as a 21 and 22-year-old? When did you start to develop this thesis? How has it developed? And how does it marry with the idea of how good of a lacrosse player he is when he's 16 or 17 relative to how good of a lacrosse player you think you can turn him into with 2-3 years of Yale practices?
That's a lot of question there. Well, first of all, I think that there's, you know, how do these kids project? One of the projections is just knowing that they're going to work really hard. And, you know, I think that we've got a really good system in place with our strength conditioning program. And I don't know that it's that much different from anyone else, but I think, you know, we put a premium on it, and our guys trust the system. They trust the cookbook, so to speak. You know, I think back to a guy like Michael Kesey, who was unrecruited by everyone. You know, he was told by Williams that he could walk on. He was told by Dartmouth that he could walk on. You know, and he's the class of 2016 college. We offered him a spot, and there was like a little bit of like, or this, you know, no one else wants this kid, almost literally. Kind of, what are we doing here? But he was so diligent, and he worked so hard. He did everything that we asked him to do. You know, lift this much weight on this day, this many times, and he did it, you know, to a T every single time, and it paid off for him. The same way with Ben Reeves and most of his class. Those guys, they just listened. They did what they were supposed to do, and you know, it ended up working out for them. So I think that, you know, with respect to the projection, it's how much is this kid willing to put into it? And he doesn't necessarily have to do more than what our strength coaches say. He just needs to do exactly what they say. And if he has the potential, you know, then it's going to pay off. So that's kind of the biggest thing. I mean, there's a lot of great athletes out there that never wanted to work at it at all. You know what I mean? So I think that's the biggest thing. I think that I hope I'm not skirting your question by forgetting exactly how you worded it, but, you know, then there's the projection now is we just try and figure out the guys that are going to thrive both from a commitment standpoint and then who's going to thrive from a potential standpoint. So, you know, there's a lot of things that go into that factor. For instance, you know, we recruited Joey Sessa at 5'5", but you know, if Joey Sessa was 6'5", then he could have put a lot more muscle on his frame than he's able to. It's just a simple, he can, you know, guys like Joey Sessa and myself can only get wider. They can't get that much taller and wider. So that's a big part of it as well, making sure that the, you know, guys that are bigger can get get bigger and faster. Guys that are taller, I should say, can get bigger and faster. This whole thing happened when I met Thomas Newman, who helped our program out and consulted initially and then became a strength coach at Yale. And we kind of let him, you know, run with it. This is whatever he told us to do. Do this with this guy. We said we're going to do it. And, you know, we consulted him on certain guys that we were recruiting. And you know, he's not perfect either. He told us not to recruit Matt Brandau because he thought his potential was suboptimal, as he said. But it turns out it was, you know, he's a pretty good poster child for how hard you work and what how that pays off. So, you know, it's not a. And then the third part of your question is, you know, how do you marry this with the stick skills and all that? It's a big soup of decision points. You know, it's like this kid's this good an athlete, he's this good a student, he's this seemingly diligent, and you know he's got this much athletic potential moving forward. Very few guys have ever hit all four of those metrics, if that's all four of them, to be honest. But if I'm saying that off the top of my head, there's other things that have cropped up, you know, recommendations, coaches, and that type of stuff. So it's the guys that hit all four, you know, that's hopefully who we're going to get the most out of. But we've missed on those guys too.
So one, you know, this is a two-track conversation relative to the way in which your commitment and understanding of how you try to evaluate has evolved. And, you know, the way you started answering the question can sound like coach speak to someone who just, I don't know, wants it to sound like coach speak. It does. The commitment level is the starting point. And that's where one of the most interesting conversations that I think you and I have had over the last 15 years is around the difference between recruiting to a Yale where, generally speaking, kids didn't want to go. It wasn't, you know, great weather. It was going to be hard academically. And even though the quality of the degree and the quality of the experience were likely to be really high, it didn't have the historic reputation lacrosse-wise that some of your competitors did. And then you find success, and in 2018, there's a, you know, a binary shift in terms of the way in which the program is perceived. You can now go to Yale and get all the other benefits that you've been able to get, plus you can compete for a national championship. And what we've discussed is the way in which the challenge shifts from essentially hunting to choosing. Now, there are very few conversations, relatively speaking. Obviously, the academic component of it is an important one, but relatively speaking, there are fewer conversations that you can't have with prospective athletes. And the challenge for you becomes sussing out the ones who want to do what you want them to do or are going to do what you ask them to do, as opposed to taking a kid who wants to come to Yale because he thinks that he has a chance to win a championship. How have you regarded that challenge over the last 5 years?
It's been very difficult to kind of go at it the same way. You know, it used to be like, hey, you tell a kid, hey, this is how hard it's going to be, and this is what it's going to take, and blah, blah, blah. And as you mentioned, it wasn't a school that had been the national championship game. So, you know, that piece of it, that kind of afterglow wasn't on there. So it was, I think that filtered a fair amount of guys anyway. But you know, since 2018, 19, it's gotten harder to convince kids that it's not a talent-based process here. And, you know, when a kid sits down, they'll hear what they want to hear. And it's like, listen, man, we don't win games because we're Yale, or not exclusively because we're Yale. But I think that, you know, the kids, like I said, hear what they want to hear. They're like, okay, this is Yale. It's what I watched on TV. It's going to be, you know, roll them out and let the talent take care of itself. And we've never been that. I think we've proven the last couple of years that we're not that at all. And we got to get back to, you know, winning games the way we can. So
you use an expression that involves a metaphor of a cave. What can you tell us about the cave and what it means and entails?
The cave is, we talk about the cave, in the context that the things that we do are a little bit mysterious. And, you know, when we introduce our program to guys, it's like, hey, here's what we do. It's going to be really hard and blah, blah, blah. Once again, not anything different than what anyone else says. But if we tell enough of a ghost story that hopefully we get the right guy, through the process and the cave, the allegory is that like I said, it's dark, it's mysterious, sometimes a little bit scary. And if we talk about it the right way, then we're going to have guys that are fascinated by that, not afraid of that. So we want guys that want in the cave, so to speak. And once again, I hate talking about this because it sounds that's not proprietary. There's a lot of teams that do that. We just describe it that way. You know, and so if we can get guys that are fascinated by that and want in the cave, so to speak, then we should be just fine. We have guys that come here because we've got simply because of the degree and the history and the, you know, the ridiculous building that our generous benefactor has donated, then that's not exactly the kind of cave dweller that we want necessarily. It could be, it might be, but we have to be sure that there's some part of him wants in the cave.
It's got to be a challenge, not just because of what I think is kind of the preeminent factor that I laid out, which is, you know, that binary distinction between, you know, success and aspiration or aspiring to success. But you've also dealt with like a pandemic shutdown that cost you two seasons, the building of an incredible building that you just referenced, that now runs the length of one end line of Reese Stadium, the changing college athletics landscape that includes name, image, likeness, revenue-based or income-based opportunities, and all sorts of considerations around, you know, mental health and wellness and you know, issues around gambling and legalized marijuana. And the point I'm getting at is that, like, the challenges are so numerous that controlling for any individual variable is almost, if not completely impossible. So as we kind of wind this question down and focus a little bit more on how you're approaching the class of 2025, how has the job of recruiting at Yale changed?
It's changed a lot, you know, and I think that in order for us to still be good, we're going to have to roll with those punches as well. The pandemic was a curveball that I don't know if we handled well enough at all. The NIL stuff remains to be seen. That's impact on our sport, but there's stuff going on right now that's pretty eye-opening, to those of us that aren't necessarily, partaking in it right now. Yeah, I mean, it's like anything else. Nowadays, changes come real fast and sometimes violently. So, you know, I think for us if nothing else, the pandemic and these, you know, these other things have taught us that we have to stay true to what got us to that point. And more than anything else, more than really any other time in our past, is we got to get back to that. And, you know, hopefully it's still good enough in the the way in the new landscape. My feeling is that it is, but you know, that remains to be seen. So the class of 2025, you know, we know a fair amount about them, and we know what we've seen on the field, and we'll find out about what they look like on paper and moving forward. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see. I think this is going to be the first year, that we really see, some big NIL kind of seismic moves with this class, but we'll see.
Yeah, that's an interesting conversation. I am a little skeptical, only insofar as I do think it had an influence on the class of 24, not in practice, but in theory. I think a lot of kids had their decisions influenced by the notion that something could exist as opposed to something that does tangibly exist. And the question becomes, as it transitions towards something that does tangibly exist, how substantial is it? And how does the substance of that, how does the size of that opportunity and the certainty of it correlate to, you know, the other elements of certainty that have been the basis of recruiting for years, such as, you know, admission support and scholarship assistance and financial aid and all the other appeals of individual programs. So, you know more than I do, and so I'll defer to you, but my expectation is that 25 will look like either a transition year where there's small but significant, and when I say small, I mean few. I don't mean small dollar on a relative basis. Few but substantial and significant offers that influence decisions, and then they become more numerous for the class of 26, or it's a little bit of a boogeyman that either never manifests or takes a very long time to manifest relative to the speedy transition that we've seen over the course of the last 2 years and how it all affects the psychology of the process. But it's interesting because it does, you know, in some respects, come at odds with what you have kind of laid out over the course of everything leading up to this point in the conversation, which is, it's funny, you know, you talk about the notion of the cave being dark and scary, you know, and saying that it's not proprietary. I know that you and your staff have a reputation among, you know, whether it be club directors or high school coaches as, and then subsequently the athletes. And I think that this is also very geographically, you know, kind of different or differentiated. Basically, it's like you're going to get loved up by a lot of other college coaches, and don't expect that from the Yale staff. You know, so as kind of like a third party, I can say that I think that's your reputation in a lot of places. If you're, it's got to be hard to do that. And then, you know, on the other hand, say, but we're going to be able to offer you this amount of cash if you post this many times on Instagram. And so I think that, you know, we're stacking challenge on top of challenge, and, you know, for you and your peers that want to operate similarly, you know, I would imagine that that's going to be an interesting kind of sea to navigate.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I think that the, you know, the whole notion that the NIL is supposed to happen independently of the coach is the only part of it that I think I like. If we ever get to a situation where somebody ends up paying for our kids' education, then I would love it to be someone else's decision. So, you know, it doesn't suit me, that the NIL thing. So I hope it's the boogeyman, like you said. And you know, we'll see what happens moving forward. But, if I looked at it at its core, if it was possible to say, okay, just, you know, here's a pile of money and give every kid a certain percentage of scholarship, irrespective of their ability or performance or whatever. And then they run a charity for whatever, underprivileged kids that play lacrosse. That would be awesome if I could make that wish. But, and once again, I don't have anything to do with who gets what. Then we could probably you know, keep up with the Joneses or whatever. But remains to be seen how much these schools are going to be willing to commit to this long term, because it's still lacrosse, and you know, it's not football. So I'm not sure how much money needs to get injected into it.
So,
or how much can.
As we wind down the conversation, you know, I mentioned that in prior podcasts, structured it, evaluation and then communication. And we've talked a lot about both on kind of a little bit more of a timeline basis. But to wrap things up in terms of how you expect, or how folks listening to this should expect communication from Yale starting on September 1st and going thereafter to occur, what does it look like? How do you approach it? And, you know, how big do you want your list to be? Do you structure or tier out emails versus texts versus phone calls versus home visits versus campus visits? And where, on the basis of, you know, the at the very least the class of 24, how quickly do you expect this to advance over the course of the fall?
Well, I think we don't know what each year is going to be like, but typically on the first, my staff and I will text, provided we have the cell, we'll text all the kids that that we're interested in speaking to, and kind of, you know, get that initial introduction and find out about their transcripts and all that stuff, and then kind of get to know them. And we will identify kids on our list that we think can play for us early. You know, when I initially got the job, it's like, we're going to get guys that we know are better than the guys we have. As we've gotten closer to the, you know, top 10 program, and it's harder to find those guys. There's just not a lot of guys that we look at and be like, yeah, that kid's better than the guys we have. So, we're looking at guys that can help us. And if that's on our list, you know, if that is one guy, nationally, then he's going to get a lot of attention. I don't know how many kids we contacted on the first last year. It's probably something that'd be worth tracking, but, you know, when we get our list together for the year moving forward, I can tell you right now how many guys are on here now. You know, there's about 100 attackmen. There's about 150 middies. There's about 100 defensemen. So, you know, there's guys that are on our list that we just say, okay, we're gonna keep an eye on this kid and you know, see where it goes. We see them over the course of this summer, and they get elevated or relegated, depending on what we see. And that's a process that's going to move along, you know, over the course of the year. So this list will grow over the course of the year and, you know, shrink to a certain extent. You know, the 24 class has 160 total attackmen that we looked at. Let's see here. About 200 middies that we looked at. So it'll grow, and then we'll move kids, you know, up and down. And we have each member of the staff within the rules, you know, tell me what they think of them. So our guys that aren't allowed to go on the road just sit on YouTube all day. And they provide evaluations too. So, and then we fight over every guy, whether or not we take them or not, or offer them or whatever.
It actually raises a really good question. How important are highlight videos? And do you have any recommendations for kids who are making their highlight videos right now as they listen to this?
Yeah, I think I think they're very important, at least for us. Right now, they're really important for the class of 26, because once everything settles in the 25s and we won't finish our class, you know, we still haven't finished our 24s. So, but once things calm down, let's say by maybe November or so, it's, you know, everything is watching 26 highlight reels and plugging them into our database and saying, okay, this is a kid we want to keep an eye on. I want to look at a highlight reel just because I want to see right away if a kid, you know, can play or not. If he's the type of kid that's going to be, you know, even viable for us, I'm gonna see it from a highlight reel. I'm not gonna see it from a full game tape. So it's kind of like the initial proving ground is the highlight reel. Like, here's his reel, and go from there. Made very few decisions on just that, but it gets you to the table for us, because that's just the sheer volume of kids that we're looking at is just immense. It's honestly too much at this point. I think it's extremely important. I think it's very important that a kid puts on there that, you know, the pertinent information needs to happen right away. If a kid, you know, he's got a splash page that just takes forever, and forever is like 40 seconds, let's say, I'm probably going to move on unless there's some other compelling information. The least amount of time invested for me in finding out if he's that good, it's really the most important thing. I can't stand when I see an ad on the front of a kid's highlight reel. It's like 20 seconds that I really don't have, given all the kids we're looking at. So that is what it is, but, you know, not to disparage a certain highlight reel company. But that's kind of how we operate. Once a kid's reel is good, we'll put that in the database. We'll keep, you know, we'll send that around, take a look at this kid. And that's one piece of the process. From there, it's okay. Grades, see him live, talk to his coaches, and go from there.
How important is it, or how beneficial can a prospect increase his chances by reaching out to you guys via email before contact is allowed?
That's every time the kids email us, you know, we can send them our prospect day invite, and our questionnaire. So that's something that it's pretty important for us. Some kids reach out to us. It's like, okay, you know, we want to know everything about the kid that's pertinent to us, and we want it to know in pretty quick fashion. If a kid's got 4.0 and grad year and is in his subject line, that's very helpful. I don't need to see, you know, a 10,000 word essay in the body by any means. If I could read that fast, I probably wouldn't be a lacrosse coach. So, you know, it's pretty important that a kid reach out to us. I don't, right this time of year, I'm reading more 2025 emails. I'm filing the 26 emails into a folder that we'll respond to later. You know, and then in the sea of all this, we typically get a bunch of kids, or maybe parents, they're 27s and 28s, and it's like, come on, man. Now's not the time. Go, you know, go enjoy your summer. Don't engage in this stuff right now. That's the way it goes, I guess, sometimes.
It is a evolution and a modernizing process. And Andy Shea, we just covered about 15 years, maybe 20, of how it's gone for Yale Lacrosse. So thank you so much for your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Good luck as you navigate the next 2 weeks that lead up to when you start being able to suss out who's curious about the cave versus who isn't, who can pass muster from an admission standpoint versus who can't, and who you want to spend the next six years coaching.
Well, thank you for having me on. Hopefully this gets us a look at some guys that we would normally get.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.